welcome to North Coast Church. Today, Pastor Chris Brown is bringing the teaching to you, so open up your Bibles and listen in.
It was going to be a big project, and it was going to cost a lot of money. Therefore, they were putting it off for a couple years. But I had friends that were involved in the program, and they were talking to me about it. And they knew I brought my leadership team at that time. I was a high school youth pastor, and we would take about 60 of my juniors and seniors down into Mexico. We would stay at a camp run by Azusa Pacific University, and we would find projects to do down there, so they would let us stay for free. And then we would do a lot of leadership training, just getting, you know, our juniors and seniors ready for another school year. But this was a different task. They had a huge mountainside behind their camp. It was outside of Ensenada by about a half hour, maybe 45 minutes. And they wanted to put a fence all the way around their perimeter. Not just to keep out wild animals, but people in the middle of the night. And they were going to start running camps for little kids down in Mexico that have never been to a Christian camp or any sort of camp before. So here's the project. They needed holes dug all the way on the steep hillside amidst all the boulders. Concrete poured into all those holes and poles set. Now, the only way to get the concrete all the way up these 12 acres on the hillside was to mix it down below on the flatland and carry it with buckets on these steep inclines, these deep ravines that were all washed out where we had little boards over these 20-foot drops. And I took one look at it and said, that's something miners should not be doing in Mexico. We'll do it. And so that was the project. We had four projects going on at camp, and I had a team of 30 that were mixing concrete by hand in wheelbarrows, putting in the buckets, and this bucket brigade that would go up and pass off full buckets and empty buckets. I had this group up on top that was digging holes, and I had three guys standing around with large poles sharp on the end, and their job was to make sure rattlesnakes stayed out of the way. It was the best summer job ever for a 17-year-old boy. And after day two, the intensity dropped tremendously. Day one, everyone's excited just to be down on a work trip. Day one, everyone's just gung-ho about it. By day two, we've got about 40 posts going up this hillside of the 420-something that have to be done. And my team's throwing up their hands. They're just like, there's just no way. The next morning, we were asked if they could use our bus to go into town and pick up one of the first loads of kids that were coming to camp. The camp wasn't set up yet. It won't be set up for a couple years, but as long as there was a flat area, someone had donated a big tent, no sides on it, just a big open tent. And they were going to have 300 kids from Mexico come. And my students, part of their work thing was just getting the grounds ready. And it was a huge dirt, dusty field, nothing growing on it. Get rid of all the rocks, just dirt with a tent in the middle. And my kids started talking about, what type of camp is this? These poor kids are going to come in and see an open-sided tent in the middle of dirt. No games, no obstacle courses, no swimming pool, no greenery, just dirt. And most of them lined the road. Their job was to cheer when the kids came in just to make these little kids feel special. My job was to drive the bus. They have different rules down there, I was told by the local pastors, who said, we can fit 8 kids to a seat. And I said, 8 kids to a seat? He's all, just trust us. How many does your bus hold? And I said, my bus holds 66. They said, 300. I wasn't working for this church at the time. Let me make that very clear. We didn't get 300 in there, but we had over 140 kids. And the small ones sat 3 and 4 to the seat. Brothers and sisters stood up in front of them and held onto the seat ahead. And they sang these little songs as they left the city. Each of them carried a plastic bag or a little trash bag that couldn't have amounted to maybe just one change of clothes for 5 days they were going to spend at camp. And when we started driving down the bumpy road and that bus started jumping and they started going up and down, the ole, ole, ole sound was going. And I just realized that would be the most fun they've ever had for this week. Because the moment they turn the corner and see their camp is nothing but a dirt field in the blazing sun, the disappointment's going to set in. As we turned that corner and rounded, the kids up front were yelling something I didn't understand. And I asked the pastor, what are they saying? And he goes, they're yelling, is that for us? The tent in the middle of the dirt field. And since the pastor hadn't been on site, I told him, I said, tell them that's their camp. And he said, "That's your camp." And the bus exploded in excitement. And my kids, who were there supposed to be cheering for these kids getting off the bus, were outnumbered several hundred to one in cheers and chants. And these kids ran under that tent and couldn't believe they were getting camp for a week all to themselves. I tell you, the next 3 days, those buckets moved faster than they ever did on day one. The next 3 days, we finished every pole, every hole that was dug, everything of concrete that had to go up there. And we started talking that night toward the end of the week about the difference. And my kids, one by one, said, once we saw those kids, how little they expected, how appreciative they were, we realized we could carry buckets and dig holes for 1 week. And I thought, oh, of course, the genius of it. These American kids that have so much just came back to why we were there and what we were supposed to do. And once they saw a clear picture of why we were there and what we were supposed to do, the chores on day two that seemed endless and we were out of energy and outmanned for became a joy on day three, four, five, and six before we left for home. Today's one of those days. Today's one of those days. If you've been joining us, we've been going through a book study. We come almost to the middle of it. And today's one of those days where we're just hitting a few verses. We've just turned the corner in the book of 1 Peter. We're starting to head toward camp, the finish line. And right in the middle of it, this guy writes, one of the first disciples, one of the original 12 that walked with Jesus, sits down and writes, "Let me remind you, give you a picture of what you're about and what you're supposed to do." And my hope is today, church, wherever you're watching, whatever campus, whatever venue, that this is one of those that no matter what you came in here with, no matter what we're struggling with, no matter what we're burdened by, we walk out with a little more energy and understanding. That's what I'm about. So if you got a Bible, go ahead and open it. We're only staying in one book the entire time. We're not jumping around today. So we're in the book of 1 Peter. Back of the Bible. In fact, we've told you since the beginning of the series, it's easier to start in the back of the Bible and find 1 Peter. Very last book is Revelation. Start backing up. You're going to pass a 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, 1st and 2nd Peter. 1 Peter, we're in chapter 3, starting at verse 17. Let me catch you up to speed a little bit if you're just joining us. If you look at the top of the note sheet that's in your bulletin, you're going to find out this is message number 12. And you go, how has the church done 12 messages in 2 pages? We're rather slow here. We love doing things. We just think there's so much in every passage and every verse that when you read huge chunks, you miss so much of what the pen was trying to convey at that time. What we've hit so far is Peter just saying, have you forgotten the type of God you have? He's not just some invisible God out there. He's not some fairy tale. He's not something in the sky that you just put your mind on every once in a while. You have a living, breathing, risen Jesus who came to earth to die, rose for you. Do you understand what God did when he sent his only son to earth to die on the cross? For the first chapter and then part of chapter 2, Peter just kept bringing us back to, this is what God has done for you. Therefore, this is who you are. Regardless of how you feel about yourself, how you think about yourself, what the world may tell you or what your family may tell you, this is who you truly are. And he kept coming back to the fact that we are children of God. We are heirs to the throne. We are prince or princess in the kingdom of heaven. We have holiness. We are called righteous. We are far from perfect, but the perfect one died for us. Therefore, this is how you are now seen. And then every time he got to what God has done, who we are, he said, now here's how we should live like it. Now that you know what you're about, here's what we should be about. And we get to chapter 3. If you were here last week, I kind of hit. Peter said, look, be willing and be prepared to give an answer for anyone who asks. Live the type of lifestyle that's different from the rest of the world. You're a Christian not because where you go to church. You're a Christian not because that's the box you check off on the census. You're a Christian not because your family was or you call yourself an American. You're a Christian because you are a Christ follower. You live differently than the rest of the world. You follow this God and his word implicitly. He is Lord. And a big difference last week between knowing there's a God and having a Lord. This rule of God, word of God, has supreme authority over my life. When people ask, be ready to share your story in gentleness and respect. And now he brings the bus around the corner and he goes, let me tell you your story. Let me remind you who you are and when. And in 1 Peter 3:17, it is better, if it is God's will, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. And that verse kind of caught me this week. In fact, it kind of caught us this week. It is better, if it's God's will, to suffer for doing good rather than for doing evil. And I like option C, which is, doesn't seem to be on the board, which is no suffering at all. Thank you. And yet at times, he said, and we've been through this, at times life's going to be tough. At times you are going to suffer. Make sure if you suffer, it's for good. It's the God's will, not your own. And Christians, for those of you that call yourselves Christ followers, let me talk to you for just a second. For those of you that are checking out Christianity or checking out North Coast or one of the campuses in San Marcos and Escondido and Carlsbad and Fallbrook and Green Oak and Kailua, the men and women that are watching us who are serving our country so amazingly well overseas, some of you are brought and just checking this out. You can tune out just for a second. I want to talk to Christians. We got to understand why we may be suffering. Some of us suffer because we're jerks for Jesus. That's not for God's will, and that's not for the good. Some of us suffer because we didn't get the last verses last week that said, whatever you do, you are doing it in gentleness and respect. You are living your truth out in a way where no one can condemn you of wrongdoing, of bad attitudes. And I got to be honest, Christianity over the decades has created such a bad name for itself by the way Christians decide to live out Christianity. And they do it with such hatred, or they do it with such ignorance, or they do it with such lack of respect to other persons, their beliefs, their religions, their philosophy. Or they do it with lack of gentleness to everyone they seem to get into conversations, arguments, conflict with. And then they're persecuted. And they go, oh, I'm suffering for Jesus. No, you're suffering because you're a jerk. Both start with the J. Big difference in how the word plays out. And he goes, if you're doing this for God's will, if you've done it according to what Peter says and they're still suffering, consider it joy. May I remind you of the one that suffered for you? It was ironic this past week. We do a thing that we call sermon prep. Whoever's teaching the message on the weekend, either Larry or myself or Mike or the guy from the Edge, we sit around. It's just for you, buddy. We sit around and we just say, okay, here's what I'm thinking about teaching. And in the midst of that, we have about 35, 6, 7, 38, something like that, people that show up every Tuesday between 11 and 12, mostly staff, so many unpaid, volunteers, interns, administrations, and they just help us go through the bugs of our message. Here's what I thought you said. Here's what I didn't think you said. Can you explain this to me? And we try to get our dumb tacks out before we bring it to you guys. Here was the irony. I sat down with our group, it's 36, and I said, how do we suffer today as Christians? And we had a really hard time thinking of it because of where we're living out our Christianity. Church, we don't suffer much in this country for being Christians. Oh, I know we came up with a list of what happens in your family or in your job place or in your work, or you may be passed over for a promotion. Let me tell you, I don't know if that's suffering. Maybe at the very bottom level, sure it is. We're mocked by people. Some of you are the only Christians in your family. One of my Spanish brothers said, you know, in our culture, if you're the only Christian in the family, sometimes they'll call you hermanito, little brother. They'll mock you for it. He goes, I've been there. Yeah, that's tough. Some of you are in a job or a workplace where the policies and the practices are unethical or maybe even illegal. That's just the way we do things. We do things under the table here. And for you, the choice is, man, do I go along with this or not? Knowing I'm supposed to be a person that brings truth and righteousness into every situation I'm in. How do I decline that with gentleness and with respect? And you go, I may be lost of job, or again, I may not be promoted. I get that. I've talked to so many of you that are in the workplace or in the military and say, Chris, how am I supposed to motivate men or women if I can't use the language that's used to motivate? So many of you men and women in our church, we have in law enforcement, they're like, you don't understand. When I get into a situation, some words are called for. I don't care if they're godly or not. And I would push back and go, I don't know about that. Jesus seemed to be in the center of conflict his entire life with crowds that were out to kill him. And he still seemed to have language that was godly. And so I realized there's places in our families, in our workplace, in our school, where being a Christian is tough. But we had a very hard time coming up for anybody that's lost home or family or loved ones here simply for following God. We live in an incredible country with incredible freedoms. And on your note sheet, a few things about suffering. Number one, let's just be honest. Most of us never really suffer for Jesus. Most of us never really suffer for Jesus. I know I never have. Have I been made fun of? Sure. Do I still have friends and some family members that think it's crazy what I do and what I give my life for? Yeah. Do I suffer? No. I got two cars. One's an older Honda van. One's a really older Honda Ford Explorer. Guess which one I get? That's suffering. My wife gets the 6-year-old van. I got the 16-year-old Explorer. Boy, if that's suffering, then put me on the list. But people, I've never really faced it. Might I remind you, Peter's writing to a group under the persecution of Nero in the mid-60s AD, where they know just reading his letter, if they're found with it, means certain death. They know in their growth groups, they'll travel there secretly. And they'll arrive at different times, some hours apart from each other, just to make sure no one sees a crowd going into the house. Because if word gets out, those are the hermanitos. Those are where the little brothers and sisters meet. That door will be kicked in and not a soul will be left alive. That's the day and age they're reading this letter. This is the encouragement Peter's trying to give to them. Hey, live a life that doesn't invoke suffering because of how you're doing it. But if you do suffer, and I put it number two, if we do suffer, make sure it's for the right reasons. Make sure it's for the right reasons. I really don't want to minimize what some of you are going through. Got an email from a great friend of mine who's in the film business. She's a part of North Coast. Who was ridiculed mercilessly this past week simply because someone pointed her out as being a Christian. And in the liberal film industry that she works in as a producer, it was brutal. She goes, do I fight back? I know that's right, not right. Do I just get up and run? That didn't seem to be a choice either. So I just sat there and I took it. And she writes, Chris and to Pastor Paul, I don't know what else I was supposed to do. And I just typed back, I think you did the exact thing that you were supposed to do. You sit there. And sometimes if you're in that position, the crowd will notice an innocent person getting victimized. And whether they're on your side or not, the way you take a beating sometimes may just be your greatest testimony. And let me make it clear, there was no physical contact or assault, but verbal words by coworkers hurt. And I get that. And sometimes we take our degree of suffering and we back up and we look at the world we're in today and where being a Christian can cost you life and death. And we get a little perspective. And then he seems to turn the corner and says, let me remind you, the only reason you are a Christian is because of suffering. And it wasn't yours. It wasn't yours. In verse 18, for Christ died for sins, once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. He was put to death in the body, but made alive by the Spirit. Could you imagine? Could you imagine sitting in a small home in what would now call present day Turkey? With a group of believers, with this church, just 30 years after Jesus died and rose again, still a memory that you have in your lifetime of what they did to him. And this letter arrives. And Peter, one of the last of the great disciples, that fisherman that walked with Jesus for 3 years, writes you this. Here's what God has done. Here's who you are. Here's what to do. Here's what God has done. Therefore, here's who you are. Here's what to do. And the bus turns the corner and he starts coming down to your sufferings. How hard it is to truly be a believer, a follower of Christ in that day and age. And they hit those words. Live a life where your suffering is only because of God's will and what you're following, not because of any bad actions. And if you are suffering, consider it joy. And may I remind you of the one that suffered for you. The perspective that kind of gives and closes in on. I just kind of wrote it this way. Number three, a few things about suffering. We can't out-sin Jesus' suffering. We will never suffer more than he has. But the good news is we can't out-sin Jesus' suffering. I love those words in verse 18. For Christ died for sins once and for all, the righteous for the unrighteous. There will never be any suffering that has to happen to have any taking away of our sins. You cannot out-sin Jesus. Church, let me remind you, in all of our campuses and all of our venues, I don't care who you are. I don't care what you've done. I don't care what's been done to you. You cannot out-sin the cross. There is nothing in your life, no amount of anything in your life that you have ever taken part of or been involved with that would cause you to stand in front of a cross and hear the words of Jesus going, I can't cover that. No way. And don't you ever dare look at your life and look at the hope of this message of Jesus and go, I've blown it. That doesn't count for me. I don't qualify for that. I'm already out. You cannot, whoever you are, wherever you are, stand in front of the cross and say, that's not good enough for me. Because let me promise you, it covers you. It covers you. Let me promise you, as we saw last week, this is written by a fisherman who walked with Jesus, pledged to die with Jesus. And when Jesus was brought to trial and was being persecuted and beaten and whipped, it was this guy that denied him three times, the last time with cursing. And he writes, Jesus died and suffered once and for all. It covers it. It covers it. It was the righteous for the unrighteous. And that's the key. No mere man died for you. It was the very Son of God, the righteous, who died for an unrighteous guy like me. It covers you. The death of Creator covers anything creation could have ever possibly done. This is your Maker. This is your God. This is your Lord. His death pays the price for anything we have ever come up with. Oh, the way he's trying to bring hope into that little growth group that's meeting in what we call Turkey today. And then they're suffering and reminding them who they are and what's been done for them. This book is not man's attempt to get to God. This book clearly shows God's attempt to get to us. Christianity is not a religion of what you need to do to be holy. Christianity is understanding that he who is holy already paid the price for you. Christianity is not us trying to follow a bunch of verses. So one day I'll stand, fingers crossed, and I hope and pray I was good enough. Christianity tells us off the bat, you're never going to be good enough. Congratulations, you lose. Congratulations, he won the game for you. He paid the price for you. This is not a book of what I must do so that one day I get accepted to heaven. This is a clear outline of what God did to great extent to get a guy like Chris into heaven. Are you kidding me? And Peter writes, it was that righteous man who died for the unrighteous once and for all. Why? To bring you to God. That's simply how much this God loves you. I don't understand that love. I don't understand the love for someone else that I even have no relationship with that would cause me to kill my own boy. No. to lay down my life, to lay down anyone else's life instead of my son. I understand that love. That's a very selfish love. The most unselfish act in history was a guy that said, doggone it, Chris, you're never going to get to heaven. I'm like, what if I try hard enough? Have you ever sinned? Yeah. End of story. Sin can't be in heaven. A holy, pure, righteous God cannot be with anything that's unpure, that's unholy, that's unrighteous. Whatever those big words mean, I know I'm it. This was God's attempt to get to us. And that death of Jesus, righteous, for all of us unrighteous, brought us to Him. Now, you want to get to some of the weirdest verses in the entire Bible? Here you go. Some of you that read ahead may be sitting there going, I hope it was Chris that got this passage. Verse 19. Oh, end of verse 18. He was put to death in the body, but made alive by the Spirit, through whom also he went and preached to the spirits in prison, who disobeyed long ago when God waited patiently in the days of Noah while the ark was being built. In it, only a few people, eight in all, were saved through water. What? The Spirit, through the Spirit, Jesus went and preached to spirits in prison who disobeyed long ago in the days of Noah? Do you ever wonder what happened those few days before Easter? From Good Friday to Easter. I know we dye eggs, we get the house ready, we get some of our Sunday clothes laid out. What did Jesus do in between when he died and rose again? Have you ever wondered? There's a gap there. And you're like, was he just sitting around somewhere? Must have been the longest days that he's like, come on, Easter morning. And you have this verse that goes, oh, it's the Spirit that rose him from the dead. But before he did that, he took him to preach to spirits in prison long ago from Noah's time. And it's at this point, I wish there was someone a whole lot smarter than me that was teaching these verses. Because I pretty much told you everything I know, and it's not much yet. So I started looking around and thought, some of the best people that understand the Bible have put some of this stuff down in video and on film. One of the smartest guys that I know and use for research and study, I thought, let's hear in his words. I can't even begin to copy it. Looks like this.
Actually, a lot of people think this is a confusing passage, but when you take a very careful look at the Greek that you find here in 1 Peter, and you compare it with the original Hebrew that is back in Genesis chapter 6, and expositionally take a deep dive into it, exegetically, carefully parse the syntax and the grammar of each and every passage, well, what you will discover is that, well, pretty much no one has a clue what it means. So there you have it, from Dr. Larry Osborne.
Next verse. A couple of things we got to get. Either no one has a clue what Peter's talking about here, or we got to get some really much smarter people help us out on staff here. And yet the reality is, we have no clue what these verses are. I've got five possible explanations of what he's talking about. And it's not even worth reading them to you because they're all hooey. There's nothing in the Bible that says what this is about. Nobody thinks he really went and talked to people back in Noah's day. They think they went and talked to maybe the fallen angels, the spirits of that time. He wasn't preaching salvation. I think Jesus just showed up to fallen angels long ago and said, ta-da! Told you I was the son of God. We pulled this plan off. Now get ready to watch Easter, suckers. And then he left. I have no idea. Now here's the problem. Some of you that are in this Bible geek stuff like me and you love reading these things, they're going to go, oh, Chris, I saw a documentary once and let me tell you what happened. And let me just tell you right now, I'm not going to listen to you. Because no one knows. There's no biblical evidence outside of these verses of what Peter is talking about. Apparently, in Peter's day and age, there were some stories about what happened and where Jesus just had gone. I mean, it was really, really close to Easter. And so apparently he's writing to a group of people that may have some knowledge about that. 2,000 years later, we don't. And so what we do at North Coast, here's let me tell you what we don't do at North Coast. We don't spend a lot of time talking about things in the Bible that have no grounding or backing and don't seem to have any difference in our Christian life and how we're supposed to live and what we're supposed to do. If this was important, I promise you, Paul would have picked up on it. If this was important, John would have picked up on it. If this was important, then my bet is Jesus would have spoke about it. And the Bible's silent on those verses. You can let your imagination run wild. If you have one like mine, I have some crazy thoughts about what might have happened. And I'm not going to discuss them with any of you. Because it's not biblical. There's no verses on it. There's a little insight into something happened between Good Friday and Easter. And Jesus went and preached to spirits somewhere who had fallen long ago. That's all I know. And my favorite doctor. So verse 21. 8 people were saved. Noah and his family through the flood. And this water symbolizes baptism that now saves you also. Not the removal of dirt from the body, but the pledge of a good conscience towards God. It saves you by the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, here's something we do know. Peter goes, just like Moses and his family was saved from the judgment and destruction through the ark, through the flood, in the very same way, it's a picture of baptism. That once you understand this God, the righteous died for the unrighteous, that he took away your sins, that you've come to him, that what we talked about last week, he's Lord of your life. You don't just believe in a God or that he's God, but you've made him Lord, set him apart from all else of your life. He goes in, it's like baptism, that symbol and picture of a mind that stands before God and knows it's okay. North Coast. Man, with the pastor's heart, as part of the family here, I just want to challenge and encourage you. Every single one of us should be in a place where we stand before God with the pledge of a good conscience towards him. Where I can stand before God and it's not saying, look at me, I'm perfect. No. It's not saying, look at me, I've cleaned up everything in my life, I'm great. No. I stand before God with a clear conscience, knowing I am his son. I do not doubt my salvation. I do not doubt my future, my hope, my glory. I stand there knowing not what I've done to try to get to him, but I know what he has done to get to me. And I've accepted that. And I've stood at that cross. And I said, I accept payment for all the junk I've done. Forgive me. I'll take it. And he says, paid in full. And I stand before God, and God sees me as one who has a whole lot to pay and make up for. And when he grabs the debt that I owe, he sees it's already been signed by his son. And God hands it back and says, welcome to the family. That's my boy. You're my boy. Welcome to the family. Because I know what God went through and what Jesus did just to get a clown like me. And that is the clear conscience of standing there. Not in any of my own right. But saying I've accepted those last 4 verses. God, thanks. Thanks for letting an idiot like me being part of the family. What a family. We don't doubt our salvations. We don't go to heaven with fingers crossed hoping we've done enough. You can never do enough. Stop trying. Now I start living out what being part of the family is in my life so that others may populate heaven with me. What a picture he's writing to the church. He said this baptism wasn't about real water cleaning dirt off of you. It was a picture that your old dirty self is gone, that you've come out a new person. Understanding who this Christ is. It saves you by the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at God's right hand with angels, authorities, and powers in submission to him. I might not be able to explain a couple of those verses, but it's pretty clear in Peter's mind. Everything in heaven and earth and now in prisons or spirits under the earth know who this Jesus is. It encapsulates all realms. And now he sits at the right hand of God. And he's there for me. He's my defense attorney. And anytime there's a charge against Chris, he simply says, paid for that kid. What an idiot. What an idiot. That's my boy. I kind of put it down this way. I think I've said it this before. Maybe you've even filled in the blank because I've said it so many times. It's a little mantra of mine. I think Peter's just telling his church one more time, number four, for Christians, this life is as close to hell as we will ever get. This is it. I don't know what you're suffering for the sake of God. It's not much compared to the rest of the world, but we still have many that are suffering for their love for God. May I remind you, this is hell. As close as I'll ever get. This is it. And San Diego's a pretty good hell, if you ask me. I mean, it could be in Minneapolis, St. Paul, or something like that. But right now, Southern California, constant 76 degrees. The life that I get to live, this is as close to hell as I'll ever get. Because I can stand before God in a clear conscience, and I know I'm his son. I know where my heaven is. Not because of what I've done, what Jesus did for me. And whatever suffering I face, whatever I go through here, this is all the suffering this life will ever get. Can you see what he did? He brought that bus around the corner. And some people look at it and go, oh, it's just a religion. I mean, I don't know why the weak and the passive need a crutch, need religion. When I see what the Father has set up, there is a cheer that comes from me. I get this. This is my home. This is where I get to stay. No way. And let me lastly remind you, and I say lastly, not because we're closing, but the last point. The reason we are blessed is to bless others. We do have a different life here. We do get to live a privileged life here. If you've done much traveling outside the United States, especially in some third world countries, you realize we have an incredible life here. And with that blessing comes a responsibility, knowing the truth about this life and the life to come. What do we do with it? And so we thought we'd take the rest of the time here and just share. I realize that this message may not be life-changing for some of us. And some of you, yeah, I'm a Christian, I already have that. I'm going to promise you, these next 10 minutes are going to be life-changing for hundreds. And it's very rare for me to make a promise and very rare for me to go on a limb and say several hundred people will find these next 10 minutes to be absolutely life-changing. But there's absolutely no doubt in my mind about it. I want to give you an opportunity, and we talked as a staff about doing that. We don't have a missions department here. We don't have a missions budget here. We don't play the middleman. We want you to be personally involved in whatever you support all around the globe. We're constantly urging you. We are here to bless others. We know the truth to give it to others. We have been made incredibly rich to pass that off for others. There's going to be a day where I stand before God and with a clear conscience, I know I am your son. Here is heaven. And he's also going to say, Chris, I've made you one of the richest people to ever walk the face of the earth. And on top of that, I put you in San Diego. What'd you do with it? Who do you have with you? And for so many of you, you're involved in so many different places. I just started writing him down, and I know I left him out. In Canada, in Mexico, in Colombia, in Peru, in Kenya, in Tanzania, in Malawi, in South Africa, in the Czech Republic, in the Ukraine, in Serbia, in Nepal, in Malaysia, in Indonesia, in Russia, in Vietnam, in Japan, in Australia, in the Solomon Islands, North Coast is at work doing some amazing things. From people here that we've sent, and so many of you that are supporting those ministries. And you're not giving your money to us, and we're sending it to a bunch of missionaries. We've told you, you've contacted, you're in touch, your fingerprints are on that work. My bet is, though, there's some of us that are saying, I want to help somewhere. I want to get involved somewhere. And I might not have much, but where? And that's where we wanted to do this opportunity. Just Friday, I learned that our fifth water well went up in Tanzania, by the way. Clear water to people that were dying simply because they couldn't drink water. And your fifth water well went up in Tanzania. For those of you that have been involved in the water project, we had 230 junior hires doing all-nighter Friday night. They were around last weekend, remember, trying to hit you up for nickels and dimes on the way out? Those nickels and dimes of 230 junior hires amounted to $53,000. That's what they said, too. Their previous high was $43,000, $53,000, just in between services, running around with white envelopes, asking for pledges that all go to Outside the Bowl, our own soup kitchen organization that feeds 10,000 a day. So many of you are involved in Vietnam and Malaysia, where now we've taught, trained, and implemented over 100 pastors in just the last 2 years to those countries where the gospel really does involve suffering for those that are going to be involved in it. Now for some of you going, Chris, where are we going with this? What do I do? It's going to sound like an infomercial, but it's very personal. Now here we go. Bruce Weidick is a professor of economics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. Because he does both economics and international studies, he always has students going, where can we help in the world today? Now we see the problem. We're taking economics. We're learning international studies. Where can we help? And Dr. Weidick was always going, well, sponsor a kid. And his class said, does that really work? And he caught himself saying, I don't know. I've just been telling him, sponsor a kid somewhere. There's a ton of sponsorship organizations. Sponsor a kid. So his class decided to take on, to date, by far, the deepest, widest, most intensive study ever done on child sponsorship. It just came out in the April issue of the Journal of Political Economy, one of the oldest, most prestigious journals in economics. Not that it gets sent to my house. Stanford Social Review picked up on it, and Stanford wrote this. The results of this study don't necessarily apply to all child sponsorship programs. Weidick and his colleagues contacted many sponsorship organizations, but only one, Compassion International, was willing to participate in the study and open their books to them and track each child sponsor money individually. Compassion International is a child-focused, church-based organization that follows a peer sponsorship model. Instead of using sponsor donations to build village-level public goods like roads or schools, it directs benefits to the individual children. Compassion, moreover, attends not only the children's need for meals, immunization, tutoring, support, but also their emotional, spiritual, and social development. In that way, the Compassion program instills a sense of hope. If you're like me, you're a cynic about all this. I know I was. This study was done with 10,144 sponsored individuals in six different countries through Compassion, in three areas, education, employment, leadership. Here's what they found. Sponsoring a child increased the probability of that child completing secondary school by 40%, completing a university education by 50 to 80%. Sponsoring a child made them obtaining a white-collar job as an adult increase it by 35%. They were 30 to 75% more likely to become community leaders. They were 40 to 70% more likely to become church leaders as adults. And the probability that one of those sponsored child becomes a teacher increased by 63%. We've been doing this for 4 years. North Coast has sent a little over $1 million in the last 4 years to child sponsorship on behalf of all of you. You're doing it. Over 600 North Coast families are currently sponsoring kids. Compassion this past year with their open books says that 83.6 cents of every dollar you give is spent on the individual child, their program that you are supporting. 83.6 cents of every dollar. At the end of this study, Dr. Weidick said, if you want to do a really good thing in this world, sponsor a girl through Compassion International. And if you want to do something great in this world, I suggest you sponsor 10. I know this sounds like an infomercial. I tell you, it's my heart. So many of you are involved in so many things. Keep doing it. This is for some of you going, I want to be involved in someone's life. I don't know how. I'll show you. Years ago, I realized my kids are going to grow up in America and be rich. I wanted them to realize daily that they were different. I wanted to find something like this. Now, I'm a cynic by nature on almost everything Christianity. I'm just one of those guys. So much stuff's done out there. Unless I see it, feel it, touch it, I just can't buy into it. So I started going with Compassion to some of their sites. Was invited to go on a trip to Africa to see some of their sites. I remember showing up to a village where they had kids that were all dressed up, and they did a little song and dance program, and I thought, they've been practicing for weeks for the Americans to come. I ain't falling for this. They said, all these kids here are sponsored by a family in the United States. Only one family per kid. And I'm like, that's not the way it works. So I grabbed some kids outside that weren't part of the program, at least the song and dance part. I said, are you a Compassion kid? Yeah. And I said, who sponsors you? And the three kids ran and took off. And I thought, checkmate. See, they'll put the kids up in front of you to give a good answer. But when you start looking behind the corners and the fences, you'll find out it all falls flat on its face. So I thought I'd play with some of the kids in Africa as long as I was there, because I just like playing and goofing off. And 5 minutes later, my shirt's getting tugged on, and I turn around, and all three of those kids are back. They had ran home, and they got a stack of letters and pictures, and they brought it back. And the first kid looked at me, and he goes, "Joneses, Michigan, you know them?" And I'm like, "Michigan? I'm from California." I said, "Michigan's a long way." And he goes, "You know them?" And I go, "No, it's a big place out there, buddy." And the next one brought up their picture of a family that supported them from Colorado. And they had pictures of their kids for the years that they've been supporting them. And I thought, okay, that was coincidence. And every place we went, I started asking, "Give me the file on this kid. Give me the family on this kid." And I came back and I sat my three kids down and I said, "From this day on, you will support a kid who's never going to have the life that you have." These are our three kids. We've had these for quite a while. There's a picture of them coming up right here. This is Janet, this is Samuel, and this is Irene. And these are the three that we pray for by name every single night. This next picture is Janet when we first started sponsoring her. I just saw that little face and I said, yes. This next picture is of a birthday gift that we sent to her with our family name on the card. And I was stinking amazed that a couple months after we sent something, I got a picture back with her and her mom and the birthday gift and a little note saying, "My mom used it to buy flour and oil and fire and charcoal, and I got a dress and shoes." This last Christmas, this is what Janet looks like today. She's grown up. She bought a backpack, two things of clothes, a new pair of shoes, and six bottles of Fanta. It's celebration. This is Samuel when we first started sponsoring him. He reminded me a lot of my boy. They each have a kid their same age. Their allowance goes for their kids, not for their toys. And this is Samuel a couple years ago. We sent him money for a birthday. He bought a soccer ball and a pair of shoes. This Christmas, it broke my heart. We sent them money above and beyond sponsorship, and he sent me back this picture. And he said, "Thanks, Mr. Brown. We bought concrete. We're going to move out of a dirt house." This next one is Irene. She's the oldest of the bunch. My oldest daughter sponsors her. This is a birthday picture from her and the same card that we sent. They're at the same facility in Ghana. And this last Christmas, she sent us this picture back. "With the money you gave us, my mom bought a pump to help with the garden. We're starting to grow our own food now. We bought a lot of cloth so we can make clothes for me and my sisters and brothers, a pair of shoes, and the ever-present Fanta." Seems like in Ghana, Fanta has the corner of the market on celebration. A while back, so many of you that are sponsoring kids said, "Chris, I'd love to see my kid." So we took 17 of you to Haiti. I thought, this is going to be a test. Can compassion really produce all 17 kids that match the photos that these families have been giving and sending letters to for the last 4 years? And what a day it was when compassion drove kids all from Haiti, met us at a hotel, and we had a day with our sponsor kids. It was a glimpse into life. It was you, North Coasters, 17 of us. It looks like this. Well, that was the last bus that just left our hotel. To say that today was emotional would be a huge understatement. The kids spent the entire day with us. They played in the pool. They're down the beach. We had all kinds of crafts. They were given incredible bags full of toys and gifts for them and their family. We fed them a lunch like they have never eaten before in their entire life. And yet, late in the afternoon, it's time for them to head back to all the cities, to the homes they came from. An incredible day. For us, would have been a day of simply the way we live. For them, it's a day that they will never, ever be able to forget. Kids saying, "This was the best day of my entire life." And It's just what your support does in the life of kids that just have very little. One day in what we would call a meager place with a so-so lunch to them just made all the difference in the world. A tangible day for North Coast to come out and say, this is how much we love you guys. We'll continue to love you and pray for you. That's the difference you're making in these lives.
Timoun, c'est un grand geste d'amour et c'est une responsabilité que l'on a parce que Timoun, c'est l'avenir au pays.
It was an amazing day of sharing stories. They brought their letters that had been written from you to them, with them. We walked through villages. Haiti is the poorest country on earth today. It used to be the poorest in the Western Hemisphere. Now it's just the poorest. And when we walked through those villages, you could tell the compassion kid versus everybody else. They were clothed. They were educated. Whenever they got sick, they immediately got medical attention. They had a church program. Compassion will only work through the local church, never on its own. And they had a future. And you could line up 100 kids and just go down the line and pick out everyone that was compassion. I asked the pastor, what's your hope for this country? What's your hope for Haiti? And I'll never forget speaking to a pastor saying, what's the hope for your kids? And he said, we pray every day for the people in your church to get richer. And I said, if your people knew how much I had, you would stop praying. And he flashed the widest smile. And he said, our people have no other hope than for your church to get richer. Because when you get richer, you will help more of our kids. And I said, I'm not so sure about that. But it's a great thought. It's a great thought. So 6 months ago, I called up Compassion and I told them, our church is rich. Here's what we're going to do. Go out and sign up 1,000 kids that will be sponsored. I don't plan on doing all of those myself. If you have a place that you're giving, if you have a place that you're working beyond your kingdom for his kingdom, keep doing it. There are many of us that are saying, I don't. What can I do? On every campus, there's tables out in the plaza. It may take a while because a lot of people may be interested. They just have this. This is the only packet this kid has. Wilderson Nelson, 5-year-old in Haiti, lives with a grandmother and 4 other kids. This is the only packet in the world he has. Do not go take a packet to pray about it. Once this packet is lost, this kid will wait 6 to 9 months before they realize he's out of the system, before he can get sponsored again. It's $38 a month. I tell you, for dad, every night at dinner, our kids take turn praying for dinner. They always pray for Janet, Samuel, and Irene. And they write letters. This is Samuel's letters that he has sent in the last couple years and what he's doing and his drawings. Because I don't suffer that much. In the world, people do. How my God suffered for me. Well, that made me a son. And from that point on, I realized I'm blessed to bless others. And one day I want to show up and say, here's how I manage your funds. And it might not be perfect, but here's some areas outside of Chris's kingdom. And this is a program I have been proud to sponsor and be a part of for years now. In 4 different countries, I've done my best to find holes in their system. I've showed up unannounced at their offices in my travels. And I've been amazed at how every kid has one family, how that family gives that kid hope and programs and the gospel, different than the world around him. For Haiti, I don't know how else to help that country. There's other countries on the table if you're interested. Some of you, it's not a guilt trip. You're doing great things in the kingdom of God. Keep doing them. This is for those of us that go, I don't know how to help. I'm not doing much. And I can do $38 a month. I challenge you to stop by a table on the way out. Father, thanks for your suffering. We thank you for your gifts. We thank you for your blessings. We thank you for life. And I just realize many times I feel to thank you for your suffering that has allowed me the life that I have, the future that I have, to be called your son. God, may this church always be a place that is mindful of those who still need your hope and love, of those who truly do suffer. I thank you that I am part of a body that gives tremendously in so many ways. May we not be driven by guilt to go to a table today. May some of us be looking for a place to offer hope and love. And may we find it. And may hundreds of lives today be changed forever because of the generosity that you've given us that we can now pass on. In Jesus' name, amen.
So before we close, if you want more information about this teaching or any other teaching, just go online, www.northcoastchurch.com. Or you can come see us at 2405 North Santa Fe Avenue in Vista, California. Check the website for times of services. And now let's get back to some closing thoughts from Pastor Chris.
So as you go, man, it is definitely not politically correct for a Texas boy to get emotional. So we will strike this message from the records. But I tell you, we have an amazing God who's done all the suffering that is ever needed for my sins. Not so I could live a life without suffering, but to show me what to suffer for. And if we live a life that doesn't have some level of discomfort, I wonder how much we're sacrificing. We are blessed to bless others. I'm so proud to be part of a church that gets that. To one day show up and say, God, we're here, and look who we brought. As that bus turns that corner, on that day, there will be some cheers about a final destination. And I can't wait to experience it with you. Thanks for coming. We'll pick it up from there next week. Until then, turn around, greet someone who hasn't quite suffered.